Hello, and welcome to the Text in Us podcast. I'm your host, George Fricks, and I'm here with my co-host, L. Grover Fricks, to resume our discussions in Exodus chapter 34.
That's right. Last week, we got all of 9 verses in.
So good.
So we're going to read the whole thing again and carry on so that we have our context laid out.
Yeah. You know, it's only 6 minutes a verse, you know, if you divide it out.
Oh, boy. So. You know, good stuff. We've got to make good time for good stuff. All right, here we go. Chapter 34, Scroll of Shemot. Yahweh said to Moshe, "Quarry for yourself 2 polished slabs of stone like the first. I will write upon the polished slabs the words that were upon the polished slabs at first, which you broke. Be ready in the morning. Rise up in the morning to the mountain of Sinai. Be stationed to me there upon the head of the mountain. No man shall ascend with you. Also, oh, that no man would be seen in all the mountain. Also, the flocks and the herds, do not pasture them opposite that mountain." Moshe quarried 2 polished slabs of stone like the first. Moshe rose early in the morning. He ascended to the mountain of Sinai as Yahweh commanded him. He took in his hand 2 polished slabs of stone. Yahweh descended in a cloud. He stationed himself with him there. He called in the name of Yahweh. Yahweh crossed over upon his face. He called Yahweh, Yahweh, God, nurturing patron, long in nose, great in compassion and truth, watching over compassion for thousands, lifting crookedness, crime, and error, clearing and not clearing, visiting the crookedness of the fathers upon the sons and upon the sons of the sons, upon the third and upon the fourth. Moshe hurried. He bent his head toward the earth. He bowed. He said, "If now I have found patronage in your eyes, Lord, walk, please, Lord, in our midst, for the people is hard of neck. Forgive our crookedness and our errors. Inherit us." He said, "Look here, I will cut a banquet agreement parallel to all your people. I will do extraordinary things like have not been carved in all the land nor in any nation. All the people will see whom you are in the midst of, the work of Yahweh, for it is an awe-inspiring thing that I will do with you. Guard for yourself what I command you today. Look here, I am driving out from before your face the Amori, the Canaani, the Chiti, the Perizi, the Chivi, and the Yuvusi. Be guarded lest you cut a banquet agreement with those dwelling in the land where you are going over, lest it be a trap in your midst. If you tear down their places of slaughter and you break their monuments and you cut off his ashrav, for you will not bow yourself to a god after, for Yahweh is jealous, his name is jealous God. Lest you cut a banquet agreement with those dwelling in the land and the people philander with their Elohim, slaughter to their Elohim. He calls you to eat from their slaughter. You take from his daughters for your sons and fornicate his daughters after their Elohim and prostitute your sons after their Elohim. You shall not pour out Elohim for yourselves. You will guard the celebration of the Matzot. 7 days you will eat Matzot, as I commanded you, for the appointed time of the month of green sprouts, for in the month of green tenderness you departed from Mitzrayim. All that burst forth from the womb are for me. Every one of your purchased possessions, she will remember the first to burst forth, the ox or the sheep. The one that bursts forth from the donkey you shall ransom in a sheep. If you do not ransom him, you will break his neck. All the firstborn of your sons you will ransom. None will be seen before my face empty. 6 days you will serve, and on the seventh you will be still. In plowing and in harvest you shall be still. You will do the celebration of weeks for yourself, in the chosen of the harvest of wheat, the celebration of the gathering at the turning of the year. 3 moments in the year. All your men shall be seen before the face of the Lord, Yahweh Elohim of Yisrael. For I will seize the nations before your face. I will make your borders spacious. Neither will any find your land pleasing when you go up to be seen before the face of Yahweh your Elohim, 3 moments in the year. You will not slay the blood of the sacrifice with anything sour, nor shall lodge for the morning, the slaughter of the celebration of the Pesach. The first of the chosen of your dirt you will bring to the house of Yahweh your Elohim. You will not boil a young goat in the milk of his mother. Yahweh said to Moshe, write to yourself these words, for upon the mouth of these words I have cut a banquet agreement with you and with Israel. He was there with Yahweh 40 days and 40 nights. He neither ate bread nor drank water. He wrote upon the polished slabs the words of the cut banquet agreement, 10 words. It was when Moshe descended from the mountain of Sinai, and two polished slabs of the testimonies were in the hand of Moshe. When he descended from the mountain, Moshe did not know that the skin of his face beamed when he spoke with him. Aharon and all the sons of Israel saw that Moshe, look here, the skin of his face beamed. They trembled to draw near to him. Moshe called to them. They returned to him. Aharon and all the lifted ones in the gathering, Moshe spoke to them. Afterward, all the sons of Israel drew near. He commanded them all that Yahweh had spoken with him on the mountain of Sinai. When Moshe finished speaking with them, he gave a veil over his face. When Moshe went in before the face of Yahweh to speak with him, he would turn the veil aside until he departed. He would depart and speak to the sons of Israel whatever he had been commanded. When the sons of Israel saw the face of Moshe, the skin of his face beamed. He would return the veil upon his face until he came in to speak with him. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Okay, so we got up last time through the verse that said, inherit us. We had that big, like, it's not a benediction. There's some other word for it. Doxology of Moshe.
Yeah.
About God and his repetition of this request. Please be in our midst. Forgive us. Inherit us.
Right.
And all of this is, well, a big portion of it anyway, is God's response to that. You know, he starts off, Hine, I will cut a banquet agreement parallel to all your people. Look here, I am making a covenant with you, right? I will do extraordinary things, he says.
Right. And I like a couple of the things in verse 10 here, I think are really cool in light of his request that he be in their presence. And it has to do with a couple of these words that you have here, or that is written here in the text. The first is that extraordinary things. I will do extraordinary things.
Yeah.
Which I think is cool because that is what we see in Genesis 18, verse 14.
Okay.
When it's Abraham and Sarah trying to figure out what in the world God is talking about when God is saying, I'm going to give you a child. And they're like, we're too old. Mm-hmm. And he says, you know, is anything too hard for the Lord?
Great.
Right. And it's that word that we have here, that extraordinary thing. Is anything too extraordinary for God to do? And here God is saying, I will do extraordinary things like have not been carved in all the land or in any nation. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So God is going to do something extraordinary, unlike anything that he has done before.
Yeah,
right?
The use of that word carve takes us back to Genesis 1:1 too.
Right.
So this is a whole new world.
Yeah, all the way back. Yeah, it's a creation thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And beyond that, even more so, right, we have this at the end of verse 10, for it is an awe-inspiring thing that I will do with you.
Uh-huh.
And that's the you know, God talking to Adam in the garden, like, where are you guys at?
Mm.
And he's like, I was afraid, and so I hid language.
Mm.
That awe-inspiring thing.
What connects it linguistically for you?
It's the word yare.
Oh, okay.
Right? And so it's the same word.
Gotcha. Okay.
I was afraid, and so I hid.
Right. It is a fearful thing that
right.
I will do with you. I like that. I think it's still really, really important for us to note as we kind of cobble together our theology around the conquest as we get closer and closer. This extraordinary thing seems to be the way that they will inherit the land.
Right.
And God at this point is still very clear that it is him who is going to do that thing, right? So before we had him say that he was going to use locusts to drive all the people out. Here he doesn't say that I'll be locusts, but he says specifically, I am driving out from before your face the Amori, the Kanaani, the Chiti, the Perizi, the Chivi, the Yuvusi, and you need to guard that I am the one who's doing that, right?
Which again, garden language, right? That's the guard that he uses in Genesis 2.
Right.
To
right.
guard the garden.
Right. And, yeah. And he's, he gives his reason for why that's happening at all. And it's not the badness of those people. Right? He's
right.
not like the Emori, the Kanaani, the Chiti, the Prizi, Chivi, and Yavusi are all disgusting before my face, and I would not have them like dwell in this land that I'm giving to you. It's not that. It's actually the problem is not them. The problem is the Hebrews, right? It's their fault mm-hmm. that they would have problems following God if they were. They would have a hard time not assimilating, right? Philandering with their Elohim, slaughtering to their Elohim, eating
right.
from that slaughter, giving away their kids to those other gods. And that's
yeah.
God's concern. It can go both ways, I think, with modern religious communities, right? Sometimes we're like, look, we don't watch those movies and we don't
sure.
read those books because they're bad and gross and they're of the world and you're not supposed to be of the world. God hates the Beatles or whatever.
Right.
And sometimes it is also a more childlike approach of, look, you know, when you're parenting, I'm not sure that you can handle an R-rated movie, kiddo. You're only 11 or whatever.
Sure.
And that has the kind of feel to me here. Like you're going to have a hard enough time with the fact that their places of slaughter and their monuments will still be there. Right. That can still be a trap for you, even if the people aren't there. And so that's why I'm going to move them all out.
Right.
I want to talk about, the line, and you cut off his ashrav.
Yeah. We're going to see that in verse 13.
Yes. You'll tear down their places of slaughter. You break their monuments. You cut off his ashrav. So the first thing that stands out to me about that is that his there is singular. I think is very interesting. It's their places of slaughter, their monuments, and then his. And I'm very curious about why it's singular. Is there only one ashrav, which I'll talk about what that means in a hot sec.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting too, in that at least this form of the word, this is the first time we see that in scripture. We're going to see the, root of this word used, the ashar. If I'm
yeah.
saying that correctly.
No, but that's fine.
We're going to see that. I'm sorry. It's fine. We're going to see the root of that word used back in Genesis 30.
Okay.
With
building your case here.
Well, the name of Leah's child, right? She calls him Asher.
Yep.
And it seems to have to do something with blessing. I'm not really sure how that.
Well, let me tell you. I don't know why it came out that way. Let me tell you what that has to do.
Yeah.
So it's wild to me that we've gone with groves.
Yes. Yes, I was going to say that as well.
If you read KJV, right? It's going to go with groves, and I'm usually such team KJV. But that makes me like immediately see the Hebrew people as like the orcs and the Uruk-hai and, you know, surrounding the Black Tower, cutting
sure.
down all the Ents.
Right.
Their roots grow deep, my lord.
Oh, boy. Yeah. So it's not the word for tree. It's not the word for forest. It's this word, Ashar
yeah.
is the root. Asherah, you know, is probably how we're used to hearing it with our wonderful American inflections. Asherah. And I mean, it's not that trees were not part of the sacred landscape, right, of ancient Near Eastern worship. It's not that I'm saying nobody ever did that. But this word doesn't mean trees. Asher, and potentially the reason that that a mother would want to name their kiddo that, has to do with advancement.
Okay.
Specifically,
some more of the Santa's reindeer.
What?
Advancing. Isn't one of the reindeer Asher?
No.
Just Dasher?
Dasher.
Oh, never mind. Cut that out.
Okay. All right. I mean, that would be great if the 12 reindeer...
We're cutting it out.
No, we're not. It would be great if the 12 reindeer were like biblical names and you could do stuff with it. But no, it means to like be able to go forward. It has a connotation with like prospering, being able to like beat your way through the hedge, right? I've been able to go forward. I've been able to advance. I've been successful. I've been able to prosper. It's an Assyrian... word.
And okay.
In fact, the name Assyria in Hebrew is just Ashur, not Assyria.
Okay.
That has to do with our Greek etymologies getting sure. into things. And that's what they named their kingdom, right? The kingdom of advancing and going forward, which biblically we have an interesting connection with because we have so many words for joy. We have very specific word for bless, but this one's neither of those, right? It's just moving forward. Sometimes we translate it bless when it shouldn't be, right? That's this barach.
And I can kind of imagine why they're doing that, right? If you think about blessing being in order that you would prosper, kind of an idea.
Yeah.
Connected to the, you know, charging forward into whatever, your
right.
destiny.
Easy to be a false idol, right? Of like, I'm going to move forward. Nobody else will, potentially.
Does this make Israel Saruman?
Cut them all down. If you,
right. Only if you go KJV. But for instance, Isaiah 1 says, learn to do well, seek justice, Asher the oppressed. So like, that's part of the definition of oppressed, right? Is that oppressed people have more obstacles than everybody else does in order to be able to be successful.
Okay.
And so the definition of allyship found in Isaiah 1 is to help advance the oppressed through those obstacles.
Okay.
You know, there's all sorts of other postures we're tempted to take with the oppressed. Like, well, if you hadn't blah, 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 those obstacles wouldn't be there.
Sure.
Right. But that's not what it says to do. Okay, so you will cut off his ashrav. So this is also, of course, as we move through the etymological tree here of words.
Tree.
Yeah, indeed.
Uh-huh.
Indeed. So there's the Babylonian goddess is Astarte. We've got Ishtar, of course, is a huge, huge figure in ancient Near Eastern mythology, so much so that she appears with slightly different names all across the region, right? Astarte is also Phoenician. Seems to all be connected. And so it's possible, right, that that is what he's talking about, right? If we're tearing down places of slaughter, they're breaking monuments, you're cutting down their giant idol that they have.
Right.
But there's also something for us to lean into there about like, what kind of like idols to success and advancement, like promotion that we're chasing our whole lives. What could we be cutting down there? Because we will not bow ourselves to a god after. I think that's funny in the English because we want a phrase to come after a preposition.
Sure.
But it's not there. For Adonai, for Yahweh is jealous. His name is jealous God, lest you cut a banquet agreement with those dwelling in the land.
Right. So we have this, I mean, the jealous God here being a name for a God. This is kind of the first time we see that utilized in Scripture. Which I always find interesting when we have something new for God, especially. And it's also interesting that it's kind of like we're talking about, it's tucked within this conversation around these other peoples.
Okay.
And their gods and the fact that they're supposed to guard themselves from it. And I'm kind of thinking of this from the garden perspective again, right? To go back on a cliche that is forever in my heart. in that, one, I just feel like we've seen garden language all over this chapter. Way back at the top. If you recall, we kind of were talking about when he puts the polished slabs in his hand.
Yeah.
To take them up the mountain.
Yep.
And we're like, what in the world is going on with, like, are these massive things of stone, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the things I think is interesting is that the fact that his hand, the idea of the hand throughout scripture goes with a lot of things, but is often power or, you know, prosperity. But sure. Back in the garden, in chapter 3, we see God saying, when he's not letting them back into the garden, he's saying, so that they don't take the tree of life in their hand and live forever. And here we have in their hand this thing that seems to be the central part of this creation narrative here in Exodus 34, this garden narrative.
Uh-huh.
And we have this language also around verse 5, him calling, which is that called that we see in creation.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know. I just feel like when we get to guarding this commandment that God gives them today, right, these laws in light of all of this, God is a jealous God. There was no like linguistic connection between God being jealous and like desiring the fruit of the tree. But I feel like outside of the linguistic part, there is a desire aspect that's going on here.
Yeah, the word for jealousy and the word for zeal are the same. Usually the translators just flip-flop between when they want someone to appear holy, they use zealous, and when they want someone to appear clingy,
right,
they choose jealous. But
right,
this is one that's traditionally translated jealous God.
Okay.
Probably because of the rest of the context around philandering.
Gotcha. Yeah, super interesting.
Yeah. Speaking of philandering, I do like that. I do like the things you're bringing in here, if only like the parallel of the potential for a beautiful garden scene where we're brought into community with one another, and the law, right, is partially a structure for how we have community with one another, right? We have festivals. We don't commit these kinds of sins against each other.
Yeah.
We worship together, et cetera. And then we're in this right relationship with God. And then they made a different choice, right?
Well, this chapter 34 is kind of starting with a mistake, right?
Right.
Right. The fall has already happened in this scenario. Mm-hmm. It's kind of backwards,
right,
storytelling, in that they've already had the calf.
Right. Right. But I bet we could find more themes going back.
Sure.
We made a different choice, and now God is coming in once again with stipulations. And there are very specific stipulations, which we'll get to in a minute. So he says, you shall not pour out Elohim for yourselves. So he's saying, don't take up theirs. Right.
Right. Well, and that pour out too, that's the same as the pouring the golden calf.
Right. Precisely. Which might seem weird to us, but that's because most of us don't cast metal on a regular basis.
Right.
You will guard the celebration of the matzot. Okay. Fascinating me. So this is our matzah eating festival. It's around Passover. It's not the same as Passover. But why is it the explicit, immediate connection? If you don't want to take the easy route of saying, oh, well, documentary hypothesis, someone just copy-pasted this section in the wrong spot.
Right.
Why does God immediately follow up these concerns about prostituting your sons after another people's gods? Which, by the way, God never references as false gods or fake gods in any way. It's just like their Elohim.
Right.
He doesn't say like, I'm the only one in all the earth that exists as an Elohim. He says their Elohim, their Elohim, their Elohim. Anyway, you shall not pour out Elohim for yourself. So don't steal theirs. Don't make your own. And the thing that's wedged right up against that is guard the celebration of matzah, or the eating of matzah, right? 7 days you will eat it as I commanded you, for the appointed time of the month of green sprouts, for in the month of green tenderness you departed from Mitzrayim. So it's like the key for us to remember not to follow after other gods is remembering our history with God, right? That God has seen fit to deliver us, to save us, to rescue us from slavery, right? From oppression, from death. And he brought us out in the time of life. And then the specific part about eating the matzah would then be less, if Passover is more focused on like God saw your oppression, God saw the genocide committed against you, and then he rescued you from that justice being perpetrated against the Egyptians.
Yeah.
Matzah is specifically about like, be ready to go. Right. It's almost like a be vigilant thing because they weren't allowed to bring any yeast with them because they didn't have time. So it's like the urgency
it's the bridesmaids with the candles.
Right. Yeah. The urgency of our identity as rescued people is what delivers us from the temptation to pour out Elohim for ourselves or to take up other Elohim. But the other thing, the next thing he wedges next to that are all that bursts forth from the womb are for me.
Right. Verse 19.
Yeah. Whether that's the ox or the sheep or the donkey, you or your kids, you got to ransom all of those. None will be seen before my face empty. Super fascinating.
Yeah.
I think that that's an analogy for us to remember, like, primary identity, you've been rescued. Secondary identity, you're part of God's household and you have to go through this ritual. Every time you would say, "Ugh, this kid that I have is the cornerstone for my household." We have to be reminded we're not building our own kingdom. We're not building our own empire of which our kids are a part. We have to ransom them to God and be reminded that our kids are foundation stones in God's household instead. So that's a secondary identity. And then the third piece, right, is Shabbat. That 6 days you will serve. Right. On the seventh, you shall be still plowing, harvest. You will do the celebration for yourself. And then the fourth identity piece then is worship, right? Because three moments in the year, all your men shall be seen before the face of the Lord Yahweh Elohim of Yisrael, which is like, you don't get that many places where you have God's full title, right? Lord Yahweh Elohim of Yisrael, which also mirrors our three pieces. Three and then four, right?
Yeah.
Lord, he's our patron because he rescued us. Yahweh, because his identity of is, was, and will be goes with the house that he's building, right? The Bechor being ransomed. The Elohim, that he is our God part, goes with the Shabbat part, right? Because we are cut in his image and he took a Shabbat and so we took a Shabbat. Mm-hmm. And then of Yisrael, our uprightness, Yasar, right, means upright, is connected to our worship. So very fun. I love all of that, because at first it seems random and you can take that path of saying, oh, just a random priest slapped it in here and that for whatever reason, or everything has meaning. Who knows?
Yeah.
I do.
I mean, I would go with the everything has meaning, right?
Right. More interesting way to approach the text, in my opinion.
Yeah. We see him saying that he's going to seize the nations before your face. That's kind of just bookending that conversation.
Right.
I will make your border spacious.
Mm-hmm. That spaciousness is always juxtaposed to oppression because the word for Mitzrayim means narrow and not enough room and compressed. And so whenever God is talking about what he's saving them to, it's always being saved to spaciousness and room for people to thrive.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that it's this conversation around like protection, right? You're going to do this three times in a year. And when you do it, I will make certain that, you know, your enemies are not going to attack you.
Uh-huh.
Right. Which is, I think, you know, that's pretty cool. I don't know that we ever see this, you know, appearing later in the text where they're like, we've done the thing or we didn't do the thing and now we're attacked or not attacked. But I don't know. It just seems like he's preemptively making a way for them to do this and counteracting what would probably be a concern that they would have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though it hasn't been spoken yet, it hasn't been something that's tested.
Yeah.
Anyways, I think that's interesting that God is doing that ahead of time. You will not slay the blood of the sacrifice with anything sour.
Yep, talked about that before. So that's our word chametz.
Right.
Which does also mean leaven, but the root of it behind the yeast meaning is that it is sour.
Yeah.
And I think that has to do with joy and bitterness, resentment and gratitude, being on a spectrum, and God saying, bring none of that, bring all of this.
Right. And he's linking that in with the celebration of Pesach.
Uh-huh.
So we got a nice throwback there. The first of the chosen of your dirt, mm-hmm. you'll bring to the house of Yahweh your Elohim, which again, garden,
right,
dirt,
right,
and
which is, I think, literally what it's talking about. You know, the celebration of first fruits, literal fruits.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and that's even in the, you know, the commentaries kind of talk about that too.
Yeah.
You will not boil a young goat in the milk of his mother. And I don't know, this isn't the first time we've seen this commandment.
Is it not?
No, because we see it in Exodus 23, verse 19.
Okay.
And it's also going to appear later in the text, I'm pretty sure.
Yes, it does. It's in Leviticus as well.
Yeah. And this is always an interesting one, I think, for us in the West to grapple with, like, why in the world is this even a thing?
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that it comes here, of all places, too,
yeah.
right? Like, why is this the spot that God chooses to introduce this very specific commandment
right.
For them to wrestle with?
Right. I think it might be because we're talking about, well, this could be wrong. I know I've heard really cool teachings on this from Foreman, from the people at the shul that I used to hang out at when we lived in a different city. So I know that there's really cool teachings on it, but what comes to mind for me at this particular moment, take it or leave it, is that he's talking about the celebration of Pesach. And in Pesach and Passover, there's the conversation around whether you're supposed to roast or boil.
Right. Right.
And so that could be the thematic link. But of course, I think the bigger ethical picture is like a perversion of something that's supposed to bring life. Don't let
right.
it bring death instead. Right, because the milk of his mother is supposed to give him life, and instead you're using it to kill him. That is a seriously upside down evil thing to do. So I think that's the point. You know, it could even be talking from a more historical perspective. It could even be an aphorism, you know,
okay.
about don't turn this upside down, kind of like
yeah.
when Paul's like, they exchanged this for this. Don't exchange something life-giving for something death-giving.
Maybe it's linked to, and this is kind of going way out there, maybe not too far, linked to the Nile, right? Which in Egypt is the source of life.
Ooh.
It's the source of all life, literally, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the fact that, right, that's where the Egyptians threw the babies of the Hebrews.
Yep.
So maybe there's something there too. I don't know. But it's fascinating that it is here in this chapter of all places, I think.
Yeah.
Verse 27, Yahweh said to Moshe, write to yourself these words, for upon the mouth of these words I have cut a banquet agreement with you and with Israel. And then we have the 40 days, 40 nights, neither eating bread nor drinking water. Very Jesus moment.
Yep. So Jesus in the wilderness is finding a new tabernacle post the philandering of God's people, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Shout out to philandering, by the way. Etymologically, I'm just distracted. I know I picked this when I translated it a couple weeks ago, but think about the etymology. Philo just means love,
right?
And aner or andros, right, means either humanity, husband or man. So it's just the love of humanity, a Greek. But oh well, philander has different connotations, so it's really fine. But you know, it's part of course, 40 days and 40 nights is a huge motif in all of scripture.
Right.
We got flood. We got all sorts of stuff. So it's not just that. But I do love a little hop and a skip over to Jesus.
Yeah. No, it's good. And next we move into, we kind of get back to Moses here, right? We've had all these commandments. We're getting into Moses again. And this is where we have the really interesting thing about his face beaming. And I don't know. I mean, this is the first time, this is a first mention here of the root of this word. And it's not really a word that we see used in other places in scripture very much in this form, right? We see it in chapter 34, and then it's going to show up once in the Psalms.
Okay.
Chapter 69, which says, "This also shall please the Lord better than an ox or bullock that hath horns and hooves," right? And so it's that word horns there, that's this word for the beaming. And there seems to be some connection in the image of this to horns.
Yep.
And it shows up in the Rashi.
It also shows up in a bunch of art, which
yeah,
is
Moses has
fun.
Horns.
Yes. The word Karen, and indeed the name Karen.
Yeah.
which you can do a lot with that, internet. Karens are people with horns.
Just like Moses.
Just like Moses, right? But what's our original picture of a horned animal in Genesis?
Rams.
Ram. And what is the ram caught in?
The thorns.
Right, by his horns. And so horns. It's a salvation image. And that also comes from, it's the word that they use, this, which is why I went with beams. It's a word used for the sun, and the rays that come down are like... you know, these glorious shoots of light coming out of the sun. Same idea, this picture of salvation, these apparently culturally glorious horns sprouting from people. And so that's why Moshe is depicted with horns in a bunch of places.
Interesting.
There's lots of fun art. There's one in my building when I was in grad school. That's the secret there. But of course, therefore, if you go with horns, you're pulling on that Akedah, that sacrifice of Isaac,
right,
story. And you're talking about how this work of Moshe in getting Torah, in the Jewish conversation is therefore connected to, you know, rescue, deliverance, salvation, which, okay. But what does Rashi say?
Rashi says that this Karen is an expression connected with the word Karenim, horns. Mm-hmm. And the phrase, the light horned, is used here because the light radiates from a point and projects like a horn from his head. And so he kind of goes into, when was he privileged to have these rays of glory? Our rabbis say that they originated at the time when he was in the cave, for the Holy One, blessed be he, then put his hand upon his face, as it is said in Exodus 33:22, and I will shelter thee with my hand. So that's what Rashi says. You know, it's I don't know. You know, it's interesting. You know, when we get to New Testament, we have a similar thing with Stephen.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's just this odd, like, why does this happen? What is the intent here? Why does he have these rays projecting from his face? Mm-hmm. Specifically the skin of his face, which is interesting, mm-hmm. right? Why do we say the skin of his face and not just the face?
Right.
And then he's going to put a veil over his face, which this word for veil is also a root. It's the first mention of a root that we only see here in this chapter. It's not used anywhere else in scripture.
Okay.
You know, so we might see...
This word for veil, you're saying?
Yes.
What does it say when it's talking about Rivka?
So this word for veil is specifically an Arabic word for veil, and it's a different word for veil covering when we get to Rivka.
Masve, meaning to cover. A coverlet rather than a veil. So like he's putting a napkin on his head.
Yeah.
Instead of a coverlet. That's entertaining and fascinating.
It's fascinating because what it makes me think of is in the garden, right, Adam and Eve cover themselves.
Their shame, though.
They cover their shame, right? It's different mm-hmm. with skin.
Right.
It's the same word for skin.
Right.
That is used. Mm-hmm. And a covering. But this one is different. But I'm interested to know, like, God doesn't tell him to cover his face.
Yeah.
He covers his face because right. the people are having that trembling.
Right.
Right? That awe-inspiring something.
Right.
Again, garden language. And Moshe himself then proactively covers himself.
Right. Which 2 Corinthians has a lot to say about that. I love that passage next to this one. A quote, "And we all who with unveiled faces contemplate the Lord's glory are mm-hmm. being transformed into his image with ever increasing glory, which comes from the Lord who is the Spirit." So in our era, we also get to experience the presence of God in such a real and tangible way that we also have beams. And yet, just like I think you're pinpointing here, that wasn't the commandment of God that he alter his appearance, alter, you know, who he is and his role in order to make other people more comfortable.
Yeah.
Similarly, right? Unveiled in 2 Corinthians. So helpful. And also, like, you know, I get that from a vulnerability standpoint. We talked before about, like, the glory of God passing by Moshe and how Moshe gets to see God's back, and how that might have been a leadership lesson from God about, like, all you're letting the people see is your back because you're walking past them out to come talk to me, you know?
Right.
And so here he's also refusing to be vulnerable and let the people see the fact that he has talked to God. He's putting a barrier between them and that experience,
right.
Which is unusual for Moshe, because usually he's grabbing at any chance to be like, I need the people to trust that I'm talking to you. Like, let that be seen so that they're less ornery. But yeah, fascinating, fascinating stuff. What are ways that we veil unnecessarily when we don't need to?
Yeah. So maybe there is still a shame element here for Moses. Who
maybe
knows?
Maybe he feels othered that he has this, like, crazy job to walk out, and not even Yehoshua is with him here to be his wingman. Maybe. Who knows? Well, next week we're continuing with what Moshe is going to say to everybody when he brings them all together.
Right.
It's chapter 35 next week. If you have questions, comments, concerns, encouragements, feel free to send them to textandus@gmail.com. We are coming near to the end of Exodus, and so we'll have a mailbox episode coming up.
Almost there.
Mm-hmm.
6 more chapters. This has been the Texting Us podcast. Thank you so much for joining us, and we hope that you will join us again next week for Exodus chapter 35.
Bye!